This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Heroin abuse is becoming epidemic across the country, and Northern Kentucky has been especially hard hit. Joining me to discuss programs and proposals to address the heroin epidemic, Director of the Northern Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy, Kimberly Moser, Northern Kentucky University Department of Psychological Science Professor Dr. Perry Lou Goddard, and Chairman of People Advocating Recovery in Northern Kentucky, Christy Blanchett. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Perry Lou, Christy, and Kim, thank you for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kim, we heard how serious an issue this is, how widespread it is in Ohio. What's the scope of the heroin problem in Northern Kentucky?
Well, we've seen quite an explosion in the last 3 to 4 years, really. But in the last 1 year, from 2014 to 2015, we saw, I think it was 745 overdoses in the St. Elizabeth Hospital emergency rooms. And now those are people who are making it to the emergency room. So likely it's higher than that. In 2015, we saw over 1,000 overdoses make it to the emergency room. I think the number was 1,074.
And Perry Lou and Christy, what are your thoughts on Narcan and Naloxone being made more readily available? How much of an impact is that having on this?
It's a no-brainer. It's an easy decision. It needs to happen, and the fact that it is happening now is making a huge difference already. How many saves do we already have from kits distributed by PAR, Christy?
39 saves as of today. Wow. through the community
distributions of kits,
yes.
Right.
And then we've also had roughly about 12 to 13 saves through our law enforcement distribution as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of what you do is you work with law enforcement agencies on training them on how to use Narcan, Naloxone, and how many agencies in Northern Kentucky are now using this?
We have 13 agencies as of today that are carrying Narcan, and we have a few more that are getting ready to do so here within the next couple of months.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join the conversation. And let's talk with Vincent in Norwood. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Great, I appreciate you taking my call, and I really appreciate that we're having this conversation in such a candid and informed way. I pastor a small church in Norwood, and I do a lot of ministry with homeless folks, and oftentimes they are dealing with opiate addiction. And the major gap that I'm noticing in trying to figure out if the faith-based community can help fill is the step before treatment. And that's, you know, most people that have been addicted to opiates for a decent amount of time have a 3 to 4 day period of hellacious detox that they have to go through. And there's a lack of facilities available for them to be able to do that. Most treatment centers, you have to have already gone through that process to be admitted. And I'm just wondering if anybody else is aware of that gap and if anybody's moving to fill it.
This is Kim. We in Northern Kentucky are very aware that we have a lack of detox beds. There are very few organizations who are really able to detox. Not that this is a role that the hospitals need to play. It's not quite the same detox as alcoholism. You know, unfortunately, it's very uncomfortable for the individual going through detox, but it's not a medical issue. It's my understanding that they feel absolutely horrible. It's true, though, that they do need to detox before they get into treatment. Now, I think that varies.
I don't think that – this is Perry Lou. I don't think that's universally required, especially for medication-assisted treatment. Now, it would be required to be completely free of opioids before someone could get a shot of Vivitrol.
Right.
But I don't know that it's essential that they have zero opioids prior to starting Suboxone or Methadone.
You're exactly right. And that's why I say it does vary from treatment facility to treatment facility, you can be induced onto Suboxone. And Dr. Sean Ryan, who was just on earlier, probably could have addressed this from a medical standpoint a little better, but I do have a medical background. You can be induced onto Suboxone if you have opiates in your system. The Vivitrol, you're right, Dr. Goddard, you do need to have all of the opiates out of your system in order to get that Vivitrol injection.
How well Suboxone and Vivitrol are ways to help you get off of heroin? How does that work?
They work differently. Vivitrol is called an opioid antagonist. So it's a long-acting injection. It lasts for about a month. And when people get this injection, it actually blocks the receptors in their brain where heroin or other opioid drugs would fit. And so if, for example, while they have that Vivitrol in their system, if the person decides to use heroin, they wouldn't feel high from it. They would get no effect. It would essentially be a waste of time and money. And so it works differently from Suboxone. Suboxone is a partial opioid agonist, which means it actually fits into the receptors and activates those receptors in a way similar to heroin, but with a long half-life. So what happens is that if people are on Suboxone, they're not constantly fighting that up and down of being intoxicated, going through withdrawal, desperately looking for the next fix, and then going through that cycle again. When people are using heroin, they may be doing that multiple times every day, whereas Suboxone and the gold standard treatment, methadone, provide a stable dose, does not get the person high, but prevents them from going through withdrawal and lets them achieve stable lives. They are able to hold down jobs. The methadone clinic, for example, opens at 5 o'clock in the morning, so mm-hmm. people can go and get their methadone dose and then go to work. It's designed for that.
That's right. And the methadone clinic, while we're on that subject, I believe that they are seeing roughly 1,200 patients a day. So it's widely used. It is allowing people to function. Medically assisted treatment really has become the best evidence-based practice for treating opiate use disorders, substance use disorders.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not new evidence. This evidence has been around.
Not at all.
No, for methadone, it's been 40 years of evidence.
Right.
Yeah.
Christy, tell us about people advocating recovery in Northern Kentucky. Tell us about the organization you're with.
So we're an organization that works to break down the barriers to recovery. And that is, we hold recovery summits. We have one coming up on April 30th for anyone that's in recovery. We're doing training workshops. We did an informal survey last year, and we found what is to be the top 10 barriers to recovery. And that is given to us by people that are currently in recovery now. And we have addressed each one of those barriers, and we're holding separate workshops for each one of those. And that is going to run on April 30th from 8:30 to 4:30. We also do advocacy with the Senate bills that we have running through right now down in session in Frankfurt. We go and we advocate for the things that are going to help in any way to reach for someone to reach that recovery process and to keep them going in that recovery process any way that we can. We really like to get involved with the community. We do provide naloxone for community members, family members, things like that, as well as being involved with larger community groups such as the Heroin Impact Response Task Force, the coalitions within each of the counties, and, just like the law enforcement trainings, we are involved in that as well. So,
what about, you were talking about barriers. What are some of the barriers people face to recovery?
Some of the biggest barriers are transportation. Once people are in recovery, there are a lot of things that are expected of them. They have to get to meetings. If they're court mandated, they have to get to those AA meetings or their NA meetings or whatever type of meeting that they need to go to. Another one could be housing, financial, learning life skills and things like that. as well as what their family members expect of them in their recovery and how they expect them to act. You know, they deal a lot with trying not to let other people down, but then be positive in the recovery at the same time.
Is stigma a problem? Is that a barrier to recovery?
Absolutely. Stigma is a big problem.
Yeah. Yes, my students and I are doing research, in fact, on trying to identify sources of stigma and how to reduce the stigma. One of the things that we think matters, and this is also consistent with messages from the drug czar, Michael Botticelli, is what we say, the language we use matters. So when I talk, I try very hard never to say the word addict. I talk about people who use heroin, people who have a heroin use disorder. I try to put the person first instead of trying to identify the person with the disorder or with the drug use. We treat people as people first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the way the media portrays people who have an addiction?
I have some problems with it. I wish that they didn't say addict so much. I mean, I think they're certainly not, it's not their job to edit the people they're interviewing in their sources, right? So they want to use the words that the person they're interviewing uses. But I think we could get away from saying addict so often and instead say person who uses heroin, person who's addicted to heroin,
right,
et cetera.
It's within our own community, and the way that, first of all, it's teaching people that have an opiate use disorder how to speak about themselves. Because a lot of time they fall into what everybody else refers to them as. And when they learn how to speak about themselves, such as, hi, I'm a person that's in recovery, and really speaking up and giving that information, first of all, the silence and not talking about it is killing people. Mm-hmm. And then second of all, the way that they're speaking about it is a huge step forward, because if they can say, you know, I'm a person that's in recovery, and people can see what's happening with them and that recovery is possible and they can do it, that's going to make all the difference in the world in changing the stigma and the way that people are looking at it today.
Yeah, I guess people are reluctant to go through recovering because of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they're labeled. And I think that there's, you know, in our community, there is a lot of awareness about this problem. People are crucial. You know, I mean, they hear about the negative side of addiction and the substance use disorders. I just did it, didn't I? But it is, that is the problem, is addiction. That they are aware of the problem, but they do often refer back to this incendiary language, junkie, addict, and all of the labels that, like you said,
I would
you know,
think
the
user would probably be on the list as well.
User, yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 513-419-7100. Let's talk with Josh in Covington. Hi, Josh.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
So first of all, the numbers are absolutely staggering. I just had sort of two questions. One is, with the panel, one is, why heroin? Why is it heroin and not other drugs? And then also, why now? Is this something that we are seeing in terms of this explosion of numbers? Are we seeing this now? Why not, I don't know, 5 years ago or something to that effect? Just curious. But thank you for your insights. This is really helpful.
Thank you, Josh.
Right. Do you want me to take that one?
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I'll start and you can chime in. I think that we've for a long time, our society has dealt with a prescription drug problem. And I think that that's really primed the market, if you will, for the heroin issue that we're seeing now. We have been marketed to by pharmaceutical companies. We have been prescribed opiates for legitimate reasons often. You know, there are a lot of variables in terms of why someone becomes deals with an addiction and someone doesn't. There are some genetic predispositions and all of that. But we as a society, I think, are so used to medicating and dealing with our pain with opiates, whereas I think that we are really, and I know that the medical side of things now is really starting to deal with that. The physicians are seeing that there has been a problem with over-prescribing, and they're looking for alternative forms of treatment. So that's number one. I think we really primed attitudes and the society with opiates. Secondly, in 2012, Kentucky passed House Bill 1, and that closed down and shut down pill mills, and that was the goal, and that's a good thing. But there were human beings attached to those clinics, and those human beings could no longer get their prescriptions, and they were addicted to opiates, and so it just pushed them onto the black market or onto street drugs. And heroin is a whole lot cheaper than a dollar a milligram for OxyContin.
Absolutely. In hindsight, we probably should have known. When mm-hmm. half the pill mills were shuttered overnight, we should have known that that was going to create a market for people to find other sources of opioids. And if they couldn't get illicit opioid medications as easily, which they couldn't mm-hmm. once the pill mills dried up,
right.
then heroin works in exactly the same receptors in the brain. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same type of drug. And if you read Sam Quinones's book, Dreamland, you'll see that some really very inventive and entrepreneurial drug gangs in Mexico stepped
right.
in to fill the void. And
they
provided mm-hmm. black tar heroin and a very really sophisticated marketing mm-hmm. technique for distributing it, and that just helped perpetuate the problem. And also the absence of treatment. We really didn't have treatment
right.
even when people wanted to stop.
Mm-hmm. We just were not prepared.
Right.
And, you know,
sounds like there wasn't an alternative for people who were addicted and needed
right.
help getting off this and recovering.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, so, you know, I think that we're seeing now, and you know, I don't want to say too little too late ever, because I think that we are recognizing the problem now, and we're really taking some pretty big steps to remedy the problem.
513-419-7100, if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk with Mike in Fayetteville. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm just curious how we can ever treat people when basically, they have to hide because they're involved in something that is illegal. It seems that if we had, it's such a simple idea to let freedom reign, but we're afraid of that. We're afraid to let other people make their own decisions, which they're going to make anyway. And so as a result, we have 100,000 Mexicans and who knows how many from other cultures die because we will take drugs anyway, and then we can't get treatment except those who are better off. So it's really a class war on the poor stuff of us until we treat everybody and allow people to make their own decisions.
Mike, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. And I guess that goes back to the whole idea. There's a stigma surrounding this, and there's also mm-hmm. the legal issues and legal complications that
Absolutely.
Could occur.
Absolutely. And right. there are some solutions to this that some of the panelists in the earlier group were talking about. For example, in Portugal has, in 2001, did a nationwide decriminalization of drug possession, all kinds of drugs, including heroin, including cocaine, including marijuana, for personal possession. That is not the same thing as legalization at all. So it's not the same thing as, hey, we've got drug shops on every corner, like, for example, we have in Colorado selling recreational marijuana. All it did was to start treating possession of drugs as a public health problem. So when a person in Portugal, for example, is found to be, for example, using drugs in a public place, that person will be detained, but instead of being arrested, instead of acquiring a criminal record, instead of being sent to jail, they're sent before what's called a dissuasion committee that includes a social worker a psychiatrist, and an attorney. And
I hate to use this word, but it sounds like an intervention of some kind.
No, it sort of, but instead of trying to shame them into changing, it says, let's take a look at you as an individual and see what your particular needs are.
Right.
And they provide an individualized approach to treatment, which might, in fact, be something like harm reduction. It might be something like, all right, you're not ready to stop using heroin right now, but we're at least going to make sure you're getting sterile injecting equipment. It might be, let's make sure you don't have hepatitis C and protect yourself against that. So it's, and for some people, it might be, all right, you're ready for traditional rehabilitation treatment. Let's get you detoxed and into treatment and right. get you stopped.
And I think that some of our judges in family court and drug court, excuse me, are beginning to not quite go that far, but it's not at all the same. But they are taking a look at the individuals, and they're really trying to keep people out of that cycle of relapse and recidivism and out of the court system and getting them into treatment as opposed to always putting them in jail. They're getting more second chances, if you will, to really get into treatment and to meet some criteria that the judges put in place, but they are getting those second chances. It's not the first choice of judges in family court and drug court. We even have smart court to put people in jail. But if they do go to jail, one thing that we've done in Kenton County and Campbell County is also beginning this process, we have a treatment center. We have 100 beds of treatment in the Kenton County Detention Center, 70 for men and 30 for women. And we also offer a Vivitrol pilot so that inmates can get Vivitrol on their way out with a strong connection to intensive outpatient.
Perry Lou, Christy, and Kim, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Director of the Northern Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy, Kimberly Moser, Northern Kentucky University Department of Psychological Science Professor, Dr. Perry Lou Goddard, and Chairman of People Advocating Recovery in Northern Kentucky, Christy Blanchett. The Scripps Howard Center for Civic Engagement at Northern Kentucky University will present the next NKY Forum, Heroin in Northern Kentucky. How are we responding? What more can we do? It's going to be Wednesday evening at 7 in the Griffin Hall Digitorium on the campus of Northern Kentucky University. And you can find a link to more information at WVXU.org.